Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
It's the economy, stupid. Well, that's the phrase that's been a political mantra since James Carville introduced it during Bill Clinton's successful campaign against President Bush in 1992. Here we are nearing the end of 1 year of the Trump presidency. Let's hope there aren't too many more. And while the president has thus far failed to get any legislation enacted, he's putting all his eggs into the tax reform basket. Tax reform is unquestionably the president's highest and perhaps only priority. Which brings us to the opening phrase. It's the economy, stupid. What is the goal of the Republican tax reform proposal? What exactly is it trying to achieve for the good of the country? How might it affect the Commonwealth, America's overall economic health and stability? What role do taxes really play in investment strategy? Do you, as a voter, think the economy going into 2018 is in need of tax-driven stimulation? So far, the main objections we've heard to the tax reform proposal have been that it helps America's richest at the expense of everybody else. So one would assume pretty much all people with wealth would be full of enthusiasm as they stand to benefit significantly. Well, it may cause a bit of cognitive dissonance, but there are actually many wealthy Americans who oppose the Republican plan to give them a lot more money. In fact, as the press release from United for a Fair Economy and Responsible Wealth announces, more than 400 wealthy and upper-income taxpayers, including billionaire financier George Soros, former Rockefeller Brothers Fund chair Stephen Rockefeller, and filmmaker Abigail Disney, have signed a letter calling on Congress to reject the Republican tax plan that gives tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. I know it's hard to believe anyone could be actively working to prevent tax cuts that would directly benefit them, but it is true. Many of America's wealthiest understand they are not islands of stone unaffected by the economic river that flows around them, and that America's founders knew what they were talking about when they referred to our new republic as a commonwealth, meaning that it is essential that our system serve everyone, that the rich are not immune from economic vicissitudes. In other words, that having a few very rich in great numbers without economic security is highly dangerous to us all, very dangerous to our democracy. The republic itself is threatened by huge gulfs in wealth. It does seem that our elected officials often tend to pay more attention to people of wealth than the rest of us. So perhaps this letter from 400 wealthy taxpayers demanding Congress not cut their taxes, maybe it might get through. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us our guest, Mike Lapham. Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Mike Lapham, thanks for being with us. He is director of the Responsible Wealth Project at United for a Fair Economy in Boston and co-author of The Self-Made Myth. He recently said, quote, "Our upper income members of Responsible Wealth understand that more economic inequality, in this case, huge tax cuts for wealthy people at the expense of programs that help everyone else, is not in their long-term interest." He also puts it clearly, these proposed tax cuts are not about economic stimulus or job creation. They are simply about greed. Well, again, thanks, Mike Lapham, for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. The 400 signers of the letter to Congress stand to see their taxes cut if the Republican tax reform bill were to become law. Why would they not want that? What is the purpose of this letter? And how do you hope to reach Congress? What's the goal?
You know, I think, and thank you, Bert, for having us on here. You know, I think there's a number of reasons why these folks, you know, most of whom are members of Responsible Wealth, some of them are members of a group called Voices for Progress, who was our partner on this, and then a bunch of other people who heard about the letter and signed, all, you know, in the top 5%, these are the folks who most stand to benefit from the right. GOP plan, and particularly those in the 1%, you know, who get almost half of the benefits. So why would they say, you know, no thank you to a tax cut? There's a number of reasons. One of which is they didn't ask for it. They don't need it. Obviously, some wealthy folks did ask for it,
right?
And I think, you know, we can talk later about who those folks are. But these are folks who get that they don't need a tax cut; they're already doing quite well. But their bigger concern is that we're going to ultimately, by cutting taxes, by giving away $1.5 trillion. You're going to force cuts in things that are important to everybody in this country. You're going to force cuts in things like Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, education, investments in infrastructure. So these folks are concerned that by giving a tax cut to the wealthiest, we're actually going to do harm to the country.
Yeah, and eventually that even affects them. What is Responsible Wealth and United for a Fair Economy? What is the mission? You know, where did this thing come from?
So over 20 years ago, I guess 1994, 95, depending on how you count, United for a Fair Economy actually started out as a group called Share the Wealth, but two out of three of those words were threatening to people. Everyone was fine with the, but we changed our name to United for a Fair Economy,
right.
And began doing work looking at, you know, the broadly looking at income inequality and wealth inequality and how those underlie a lot of other problems that are going on in our society. And after a couple of years of this, working on issues like CEO pay and doing a lot of street theater with something we call the 10 chairs exercise, where you divide, you know, 10 chairs, each representing 10% of the wealth, and you have 10 volunteers sit in the chairs according to how wealth is actually distributed. You know, that type of street theater and popular education work that United for a Fair Economy does really grabs people in a different way than, you know, a policy paper or someone just talking at them.
Right.
We really engage people with their own experience and knowledge. After a couple of years of doing that, we started to get, you know, we'd do a presentation at a church or something, and you'd get someone would come up later and say, I'm one of those people in the top 5%, in the top 1%, I'm a CEO, I'm an inheritor. What's my role? And we realized that, you know, the voice of greed was really well represented in Congress, in the media, in corporate boardrooms. But there's this other voice. There's voice of these wealthy people who get that more inequality is really not in their long-term best interest. You know, it's not as one of our members, Sheldon Cohen, who used to run the IRS, said, any policy that's good for me but bad for my children and my grandchildren is really bad for the country. And so these are wealthy folks who, you know, for the last 20 years have been getting their voice into Congress, into the media, into corporate boardrooms, and we can talk more about how, but to raise their hand, sort of the man bites dog story, saying,
yeah,
I should not have a tax cut. We should have a strong estate tax. We should pay a living wage, things like that.
Someday, I think, I hope that psychology will figure out this problem with people who are extremely wealthy and are in an absolute frenzy for more. It's really odd. I there's something wrong with that picture, you know.
For some reason, it's human nature to want more, even though they're doing very well. I mean, the wealthy in this country, you know, we've been through a serious, you know, recession and a lot of ups and downs in the last 30 years. But one thing that has been steady is right. The very wealthy have done better and better, and they've taken a bigger and bigger share of the wealth. And so The idea that we should come along now and give those folks an additional tax cut, there's something wrong in this picture. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
Yeah, it really doesn't. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a heavy lift. I hope you're part of it. We're talking with Mike Lapham of Responsible Wealth Project about a letter signed by 400 wealthy taxpayers demanding Congress not cut their taxes. And we often hear the term top 1%. The signers are in the top 5% of the U.S. economy in terms of income and or wealth. Maybe we can define terms a little bit there. What I don't even know what the top 5% and top 1% is.
Sure. And this, you know, these 400 signers are, you know, many of them are in the top 1%, and their names like Rockefeller and Disney and you know, names like that, George Soros, who signed, a number of names that folks would recognize, and then a number of CEOs like Jeffrey Hollander, who ran Seventh Generation for a long time. People like that are on the list. Eileen Fisher runs a clothing company that she founded.
Well, what is it? What does it
go
mean?
Go down the list, but those. So there are some famous folks, and then there's these sort of millionaires next door. So you asked, what is the top 5%?
Right.
I think a lot of people are surprised, and I've been doing this work for 20 years, and people are often surprised to find themselves in the top 5%. They think they're middle class. But, you know, the top 5% in this country is currently an annual household annual income of about $215,000 or above. And then, you know, in terms of wealth, so that's your annual income. In terms of wealth, it's people with counting your house, counting your savings accounts, all your assets, you know, minus whatever debt you have. It's people with about $1.7 or $1.8 million of net assets. Puts you in the top 5%.
The 1%, you know, it's interesting, and you talk about how surprised sometimes people are because the numbers are so skewed by like the top 0.1%. I mean, I grew up in the 50s when we had something called a middle class, and the top 0.1%, I can't even imagine what that is, but there's a tremendous amount of money there.
So to get into the 1%,
right.
You know, first you got to get into the 1% before you can get into the 0.1%.
Right.
So, the 1% is income of, and I've actually seen different figures from different places, but the IRS says $465,000. I've seen other figures that are more like $650,000. But anyway, in that range puts your annual income in the top 1%, and it goes way up from there. And to be in the top 1%, you need about $8 million in wealth, in net worth. And again, it goes way up from there. The top 0.1%, 0.1%, is 160,000 families in this country out of what, 300 million?
Yeah, something.
160,000 people with assets of greater than $20 million. So, and then they have an average wealth of $72 million per household.
Wow.
And those folks in the top 1% have more wealth, about $1.4 trillion, than the bottom 60% of our country combined. So there's been, and that's gotten significantly more concentrated, in the last, just even in the 20 years since I've been doing this work at United for a Fair Economy and Responsible Wealth.
Yeah, For sure. And, you know, we some of us who like history look back to the Gilded Age of the 1890s. I think it's probably worse now than it was then. And it's really dangerous for a Republican form of government. I mean, if you have a dictatorship, you know, an aristocracy like the kind of government that our four founders overthrew in the 1770s, sure, no problem. But if you have a Republican form of government, where Republic of the People, it just doesn't work. Now, I got to ask, Mike, when I served in the New Hampshire Senate from 1990 to 2004, we tried to live by the rule, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It seems no one likes the current tax structure. It's exceedingly complicated. It's a real pain in the neck. But is it not broken? Does it not need fixing? I mean, why is there all this effort to fix this problem? Is it really broken as it is now?
You know, I think there's bipartisan concern that the tax code is too complicated. They've called this tax reform, but don't be fooled. You know, people should not be fooled. This is not tax reform. Tax reform is hard to do. Tax reform takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of compromise. It winds up with everybody feeling a lot of pain. In this case, it would include, you know, rich people feeling pain. I don't know if, you know, I'm sure you remember a few years back, Camp and Baucus. Camp was a representative and Baucus was a senator.
Right.
They got together and did a really comprehensive tax reform proposal. And they threw out a lot of sacred cows, like the mortgage interest deduction, that, you know, you can deduct right. interest up to $1 million, et cetera. They attack, you know, all sorts of things. And it went nowhere. I mean, everyone hated it. Everyone saw, you know, there was pain in there for everybody. But that's how you do it. Right. That's how you would do it. Everyone would have to agree that we all take our lumps. And you come out with something that's simpler and more fair. But I also feel like some of the complication is necessary. You know, we do a lot of social engineering through the tax code.
True.
We say we value certain things like being married. We could argue about that, but, you know, we do all sorts of things, you know, give people a break for having children and give them tax deductions for that. There was a proposal years ago to do a flat tax.
Right.
And, you know, a flat tax sounds really fair.
Yeah.
But the reality is we need a progressive tax. We need wealthy people to pay a much higher rate in order to collect adequate revenues. And if lower people are paying the same rate as wealthy people, which would be something like 19%, if you had a flat tax across the board, it would be totally undoable for the folks at the bottom. So you need a lot of that complication, and you need rules for different kinds of business and different kinds of families, et cetera. You can't get rid of it all and put it on a postcard, as people, you know,
right.
suggest.
Right, right. It has to be that way. I mean, it's money. There's a lot to it. It's not easy, for sure. And as I think it was H.L. Mencken said, for every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong. You know, I mean, you need a complex solution. In the letter that we're talking about, signed by 400 wealthy Americans, the signers insist, quote, tax reform should be, at minimum, revenue neutral, without using gimmicks like dynamic scoring. First of all, what's meant by revenue neutral? And then what is dynamic scoring? I don't have any idea what that means.
So revenue neutral, when they started out, they said this is going to be revenue neutral. Revenue neutral would mean that whatever changes you make to the tax code, you're going to bring in the same amount of revenue after you're done as you did, you know, before. So if you're going to, you know, cut taxes over here, you're going to have to raise revenue over here. If you're going to lower the corporate rate, you're going to have to take out some loopholes that make the amount that you're collecting the same. That's what revenue neutral is. And we're not in a position as a country where we can afford to give away trillions of dollars. So we should have something that's revenue neutral. You want to do tax reform, you have to do the hard work that's required to make those trade-offs. You know, they then went with this package and said, well, it's going to be deficit neutral, which means they're going to give huge tax cuts, but they're also going to cut the programs to make up for it. And then finally, they just gave up and they said, we're just going to give away $1.5 trillion of tax cuts without paying for them in any way. We're just going to add that to the deficit because we can't be bothered to figure out how we're going to pay for all that. And, you know, the reality is that down the line, that's going to force cuts
right.
to a lot of things that help a lot of people, you know, Medicaid, Medicare,
yeah.
education, infrastructure, yeah. and those things. You asked about dynamic scoring.
Yeah. What
dynamic
is
scoring just means that rather than just look at the numbers on a page and say, well, this rate will bring in this amount, you know, given how much people are, you know, how much income people have now, dynamic scoring predicts behavior changes resulting from, you know, if the policy changes, if the tax rate comes down, they say, well, that's going to make people do more of this or less of this. And it also factors in inflation assumptions and growth assumptions. And, you know, Trump and the GOP are expecting, you know, much higher growth than has been, you know, happening recently. So it's very unrealistic in that way as well.
Slippery, one could call it. yeah, we've seen these kinds of things before. Well, one thing I read that I find interesting and disturbing is that teachers, you know, hardworking teachers who aren't in it for the money, clearly, they oftentimes buy school supplies for the kids because mm-hmm. the school system doesn't supply it. Right now, if I have it right, they can deduct those expenses from their taxes. Under this proposal, if a teacher brings in school supplies and pays for them, him or herself, that's no longer tax deductible. Is that accurate? Do you know?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things in this, and you hear people talking about what this does for middle class folks, middle income or lower income folks. They will always talk about the positive things it does, but there's a lot of things in this bill that are really hurt middle income folks and people like teachers, or you know, the guy who was on the radio last night talking about his being a welder, and he gets to he goes all around the country and deducts those expenses from his taxes.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that they're sticking it to the middle class on the ability to deduct, like you're saying, expenses like that. Student loans are going to be, you know, there's 12 million people, I think, who now use a student loan interest deduction, and they would pay more. Graduate students would be taxed on their scholarships. I mean, there's just crazy stuff, cuts to Head Start and Pell Grants. It's shameful, but you won't hear Mitch McConnell talking about those things that are going to make it worse. And in fact, over the course of this whole tax bill, what they've done is they've front-loaded some of the goodies for middle-income folks, but they phase out over time. And they've done the math, and by the end of this thing, 75% of the country is doing worse. Anyone making less than $75,000, which is probably about the same thing.
Right, true.
It is actually worse off under this bill. And the folks who, and the things that are not expiring are the tax cuts for rich people and for corporations. So it's really even more shameful than it looks on the surface.
Wow, that seems sort of hard to do. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Mike Lapham, Director of Responsible Wealth Project of United for a Fair Economy. We're talking about a letter that was sent to Congress from 400 wealthy American taxpayers demanding Congress not cut their taxes. So education, you know, it amazes me how the rest of the world invests in education because they know it pays off. I mean, any business knows you got to invest prudently to prosper in the future. Cutting education. What about the environment? More and more people are concerned about the environment. Does the tax cut as proposed, the tax so-called reform bill, have effects on environmental preservation?
You know, I'm not an expert on all aspects of this bill, sure. But to my knowledge, they're keeping in a lot of the tax breaks that go to oil and gas and coal, you know, the sort of old energy, and a lot of the new tax benefits that have been in place for solar and wind energy are being eliminated, you know, to my knowledge, you know, they would also, you know, the president's dream and others get rid of the EPA. So,
yeah.
You know, there are, like I said, there's a lot of policy that's done through our tax code, and those are clear choices about who's the winners and the losers.
Let me ask about the Trump family. They are, I imagine, at least at the top 1%. I have no idea how much money they make or what they're worth or whatever. Well, in terms of worth, not very much, in my opinion, but high cost. Well, I wonder how they would make out. There are times when I feel like this guy, President Donald Trump, is really in it for himself. I mean, really, genuinely, no fooling, but in it for himself. How would somebody like the Trump family be affected by this, do you think?
Well, I mean, this bill is written for people like him. You know, it would, the pass-through provisions, which we can talk about later, you know, yeah. It's all pretty much tailor-made for someone like Donald Trump. You know, I remember going back to the Bush, George W. Bush era, and when he came into office, he was looking at if I recall, $5.6 trillion 10-year surplus. And he, you know, we had a lot of unmet needs as a country, but he said, I want to get rid of the estate tax, which we, Responsible Wealth and Bill Gates Sr. helped keep that from happening. But he did cut taxes broadly, and particularly for upper-income people. Upper-income people got, you know, more than half of those tax cuts over 10 years. And we went from having a big surplus to having, you know, a deficit, and you know what happened at the end of the Bush era. But I remember the first, you know, 100 days or so and few months of that Bush administration, every single thing that came out, and it was like shock and awe because they were attacking this and attacking that, but everything could be seen through the lens of how does this help Halliburton, and how does this help people like George Bush, who were born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and campaign contributors. How and it occurred to me that they had taken over government to make it into its, you know, instead of just lobbying from the outside, they were inside, you know, pumping out a cash machine for the wealthy. And, you know, that pretty much continued for 8 years, not at the same pace. But Trump is like, you know, Bush on steroids. I mean, there's nothing that he wouldn't do, you know, to give a tax break to, and it's shameless. You know, everything in there is written for rich people. They have thrown a few bones to sort of middle income folks so they can say we're doing something positive. But really, this is about giving a tax break to people who don't need one.
And the middle-income people, again, there used to be a large middle class in America. Really, I'm not making it up. They really did. You know, self-employed people, expenses that they have, child and dependent care, job expenses, home office tax deductions. These things would be wiped out, would they not? I mean, this is important to the middle class, what little there is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the more sunlight on this bill, you know, the worse it's going to be. You know, it's already a wildly unpopular. I think something like 30% of people,
it's the right 30%
country support this bill. But yet, I think it may be a slight majority of Republicans still support it. So maybe that's good enough for the folks on that side of the aisle. But really, this is going to hurt the vast majority of people in this country, the more they learn about it,
right,
the more they should be upset and, you know, calling Congress. By the way, it's not too soon to mention the congressional switchboard, which is 202-224-3121. You know, call your senator. If you're listening to this, call your senators,
yes,
both of them, and say it's outrageous to be giving tax cuts to the rich, you know, at the expense of Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, education. Don't do it. Call your rep. Hopefully you know who your rep is. Same number. Ask for them by name. If you happen to be wealthy, like the 400 signers of this letter, tell them I'm a wealthy person and I don't think my taxes should be cut. It's not going to have any positive effect, and
yes,
it's actually going to do a lot of damage.
And again, 202-224-3121.
3121.
202-224-3121. Well, one thing that people have said through the years, that the corporate tax, you know, it's complicated, of course it is, and that corporations don't pay the full amount. They find all kinds of ways to weasel out of it and not pay the full corporate tax rate. I've heard it argued that if it is lowered, as this bill would do, compliance would be enhanced and that more revenue would actually come to government. What do you know about this? Is that accurate?
You know, this is snake oil, essentially.
Why am I not surprised?
We've heard this before. There's no evidence that cutting the corporate tax rate would result in more revenue. You know, even Bruce Bartlett, who was one of the architects of the trickle down theory, has said, no, we never said that it would, you know, result, the tax cuts would result in more revenue. We just said that it might spur, you know, having a little bit more cash out there might spur some investment. But this is something that is just fiction, you know, pure fiction, that you can set a lower rate and somehow get more revenue, or stimulate the economy. I mean, the only thing that lowering the corporate rate and lowering the rate on upper income folks is going to stimulate is more campaign contributions to the folks who vote for them. Just outrageous.
Well, one of the signers, and you bring up an excellent point, and there's some really interesting quotes on the press release. One of the signers, Bruce McFarland, says, "It's a plan that's guaranteed to make the really rich get even richer." And he adds, "Entrepreneurs like me don't make decisions about investing based on tax rates," end of quote. Mm-hmm. That's an important point. You know, the proponents argue, well, if you give the wealthy more money, it's good old trickle down, and that they will invest more in their companies and create more jobs. But Bruce McFarland says entrepreneurs like me don't make decisions about investing based on tax rates. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why it's important to be having, you know, getting the voice of business people out there. This letter that we wrote, people can see it, by the way, at responsiblewealth.org if they want to read the letter. You know, it's from people who are investors and who are business leaders, and in some cases inheritors, but who are also, you know, investors with their money. And, you know, it's important to make that point. And Warren Buffett has said this many times. I don't need a lower tax rate to invest. I'm going to invest if there's a profit to be made. And I don't look at what the tax rate is. You know, if I make a profit and I have to pay taxes on that, great. You know, I made that profit with the support of the, you know, government, the country that I live in that has invested a lot to make, you know, the roads that the products go on and, you know, publicly educated employees and, you know, research and the internet and courts and regulations even that make business possible.
Police
so,
and fire departments,
you know,
yeah.
Heck yes, I'm going to, if I make a profit with that I wouldn't be making if I were in a developing country, you know, if I make that profit, you know, I should pay a tax and I should pay at least the same tax as someone who went out and earned that as a salary. And right now it's backwards. We're giving advantages to people who are making money from money, and we're taxing people who are working hard day to day, you know, at a higher rate.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, I must say. No wonder there was so much appeal of Bernie Sanders. Now, some argue that, if the rich really want to pay more taxes, nothing's stopping them from writing a check to the government. What's your response to that?
I love that one. I love that. I love the idea that a few rich people could just decide, I'm going to write an extra check, and that'll make up for this. You know, that'll make up for the, you know, $1.5 trillion gap that is going to be created by this. You know, taxes are not voluntary. And, you know, you can't... Charity is wonderful. Charity does a lot of great things that government doesn't do or can't do. But I have never seen charity, you know, pave the roads and put up stop signs and pay for police and fire protection, maintain the sewers, you know, inspect my food, make sure I have clean water. Those are things that we do together as a society, and we need everybody contributing to those things, and we need wealthy people to pay more. Not a few wealthy people who voluntarily pay more. We need all wealthy people who are benefiting from all the things that this country provides,
right,
to pay their fair share, which is, you know, a higher rate than everybody else. And it's not a time to be going in the opposite direction and giving those folks a break.
Oh, for sure. Well, I brought up Bernie Sanders. Funny how he comes up pretty often. He called for higher tax rates on income above a certain level. Now, people got it very confused. I think it was intentionally confused by his detractors. But to put it in perspective, for the duration of Republican President Eisenhower, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower's presidency, the top tax rate for that portion of income above $200,000 a year was 91%. So it's for just that portion of income above $200,000 a year. Now in 2017 dollars, that's just below $2 million income a year for an individual and $4 million for a couple. As I recall, the economy was in great shape under that Republican president. I grew up then, and believe it now, there was a large and wide middle class all sharing in the booming economy. Any idea how signers might feel about a restoration of this top-tier marginal tax rate? So, you know, that income above, say, $2 million a year, not a lot of people would pay that, but what about a higher tax rate for that? What do you think? I mean, you can't speak for all 400, but what are your thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, this letter that we wrote, again, it's a letter to Congress, and it's signed by 400 wealthy people from around the country. You know, actually does advocate for a higher, it not only says don't cut our taxes, because there's no point in doing that economically or morally, but it says we should actually be paying a higher rate, if anything. And, it would be hard to get back to a 91% rate or a 70% rate that we had in the past. But the reality is that during those years, we had great economic growth. And, people saw it as a reasonable thing. If you were making, you know, exorbitant amounts of money at that time, you would pay a marginal rate of up to 91%. You know, so 91% of the amount over, you know, whether it was 200,000, 400,000, would
back
be
in the 50s, yeah,
taxed.
Right.
And people saw that as reasonable. People went to church and synagogue and, we're in a community. The CEOs were rubbing shoulders with their employees, and there was more accountability. There were unions back then. And these days, you know, CEO pay has skyrocketed, and there's sort of no accountability anymore. And now we're talking about cutting the taxes on the very wealthiest instead of asking those people to pay, you know, their fair share. And the members of Responsible Wealth, the members of Voices for Progress who signed this letter, over 400 of them around the country, get that they have a responsibility to pay at a higher rate. And So yes, if their taxes were raised, they would, no one particularly likes to pay
right.
more taxes, and people will take whatever deductions are offered. But they understand that that's their responsibility, and that's what's fair, and that's what we need to do as a country to have adequate revenues.
Well, I know you have to leave in about 5 minutes. I wanted to ask, the week of October 23rd, this group paid a visit to the Capitol by members of Responsible Wealth and United for a Fair Economy. What happened then, and what can people do now to keep up the pressure? I know you said making the phone calls, it does make a difference, especially if you live in a Republican area. But tell us about that October 23rd visit.
Well, at the end of October, we went to Washington, D.C. We had members of, again, Responsible Wealth and Voices for Progress from around the country came. And we just took this message to members of Congress. In this case, most of them were members of the House Ways and Means. They were both Republicans and Democrats. And we went and, told them, we are wealthy people. We don't think you should get rid of the estate tax. We don't think you should cut the top rate, and the pass-through rate that affect, that is mostly folks in the top 1% benefit from that. We don't think that you should do these things and, force cuts in Medicaid, Medicare,
sure.
Social Security. And it had to be one of the few times that a lot of these, representatives had heard from people in, like this, who said, don't give me a tax cut. Usually people are in there with their hand out asking for something.
Right.
And these folks were saying, please don't give me a tax cut. Don't give people like me a tax cut, because I value the investments in our country more than I value money in my own pocket. It's not in my short-term financial
right.
interest. Clearly it is. This tax bill is written for wealthy people. But it's not really in our long-term best interest as a society to do that.
Yeah, it's not just a bunch of 400 do-gooders. It's people who recognize you got to think long-term, and we have to have a strong economy. I mean, you have to stimulate demand. You have to have a full economy, and that, you're not going to stimulate demand if you wipe out the middle class. I wonder if it could be this simple. The only reason this bill is being hyped by the right wing, and I can't call them conservatives because they're not conserving anything, hyped by the right wing, is that a handful of their donors, particularly the Koch brothers, who have just bought Time magazine, have demanded it. They did not invest in Congress without expecting a healthy return. I get the sense that it really is that simple. What's your take on it, Mike Lapham?
No, couldn't be. No, I mean, I would not want to be in the position of one of these Republican senators or House members trying to go back home and defend this bill. There's really, it's so skewed and so obscene, and the reasons for it, it's being also marketed very deceptively, to people. And they're not talking about the things that expire. They're not talking about the provisions that hurt people. They're not really talking about how that benefits the upper income folks. So it's being sold as, snake oil, that it's going to somehow stimulate the economy, which, most economists will say, no, there's no stimulus in here. Wealthy people and corporations have plenty of money already. The only justification for doing this is exactly what you said, which is, how can we give a huge tax cut to the Koch brothers, to people like that, who have given us money so that we can cut their taxes? And, some of them are interested in smaller government. And this is about, cutting things that benefit everybody, and doing it in a way that benefits only the rich.
We're going to switch off in just a couple of minutes and go to one of the signers of the letter. But first, if people who may not be in the 5%, what can they do? Is there a website they can go to? How can they help out this this project that you guys are working on?
Sure. I mean, I do encourage people to just call Congress, 202-224-3121 is that number, and tell them you don't support this tax bill. And that's really the most important thing that you can tell your senators. We're at responsiblewealth.org, and fair economy.org is the parent organization. I also encourage people to check out Voices for Progress, who are our partners on this. But United for a Fair Economy, you know, more broadly, is trying to educate people, move them to action that can help close the gap between the very wealthy and everyone else. We have our State of the Dream report coming up on Martin Luther King Day, which I encourage people to check out or look at the past ones, actually. If you Google State of the Dream, you'll see those. And there's a lot of ways people can get involved and just educate themselves on these issues of inequality.
Mike Lapham, thank you so much for being with us, spending so much time on keeping democracy alive and doing good work. Thank you so much for being with us. Go ahead.
I have to say, I'm hoping there might have been a miscommunication because Robert Crandall, who you were going to segue to, was supposed to be leaving at 12:45. You can try him. If you have him on the line, great. If you don't have him, call me back.
Well, maybe we should just go with you then.
Well, I don't know. You haven't tried calling him yet.
I haven't yet. Let me try calling him, and okay. I may try calling you back. Thanks much.
Okay.
And we'll be back in just a minute, one way or the other. Well, as he indicated, the person I was calling was, there was some confusion. I thought I was supposed to call him at 45 minutes past, and as it turns out, I could only speak to him until that time. He has to go off to appointment. This is Robert Crandall, former CEO of American Airlines, who is in the top 1%, and he has said that, here, let me pick up the phone, because we have Mike Lapham back with us. Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, well, I can understand. It was a confusing message that he had to leave at 4:45, and so it goes. Well, we were trying to reach. Thank you for directing me to him. He's one of the people who signed up, former CEO of American Airlines. And what can you tell us about Robert Crandall? Go ahead.
Yeah. So Robert Crandall was the former CEO and president chairman of American Airlines, in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, he's now squarely in the 1%. And if he were on the line right now, he would tell you that that people, you know, wages for the average American have been flat for the last several decades. People like him have done extraordinarily well, and that he doesn't see, you know, any reason why taxes should be cut for people like him. He was also, you know, he ran an airline, and airlines obviously rely on investment, public investment in infrastructure in our country. And he would say, you know, I've heard him say it to me and others, that the infrastructure in our country is in bad need of repair, that we're it's actually hurting our businesses these days, that we don't have good infrastructure, roads, bridges, airports, etc. And if you take $1.5 trillion out of our revenue, government revenue in the next 10 years, you're not going to be able to make those investments that we should be making in the future to have a strong economy. If wealthy people, you know, want to see our economy thrive and themselves thrive, right, we need to have more money in the hands of working people, and we need to have investments in things like infrastructure that make those businesses succeed. So I'm sorry we couldn't get him on the...
That's all right.
But he's a very... forceful and pulls no punches on this.
Well, you some terrific people on that list of signers, and I urge people to go take a look at that. And just before, and I got some other quotes from other people who signed on, and impressive people there. I found it fascinating that one of Trump's he handled the digital aspect of the campaign. And it was very, very in-depth, finding out what people cared about. And this guy said, I don't remember his name, but he said that the thing that most people care about is infrastructure improvements, because we all recognize, like airports, for example. I mean, American Airlines, they kind of need dependable airports and guidance systems there. And Nobody's talking about that. It would cost a great deal of money to invest in the infrastructure, but guess what? It would create a lot of jobs. It would put a lot more money in the hands of working people. It amazes me. There's so much work to be done. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the most well-known names on our list is Abigail Disney, who's the great granddaughter of Walt Disney and his brother Roy, who started the Disney Company.
Right.
And she will say, that company would be nowhere if it weren't for publicly educated employees, if it weren't for roads, if it weren't for patent law. People don't think about that. How does government make business possible? It makes business possible by having a set of rules that we all play by and enforcing those rules and saying, oh, well, you had a contract with that person. You need to live up to that. You mentioned the book, The Self-Made Myth, that we wrote.
Yes.
In that book, we profile someone named Anirvan Chatterjee, who started Bookfinder.com. And in his profile, there's about a dozen profiles in the book that are really great. But he's saying, without, that ability to enforce the contracts, I made contracts with all these different companies that were part of my Bookfinder.com website. And if I had to actually try to enforce them myself, it would never happen. But because people knew there was a system of courts and law that were going to back up those contracts, they followed them. And that's how business, all sorts of businesses at all levels do, and it's something that we take for granted, but it's something that government provides.
Yeah, that's a very good point that I hadn't thought of, but the whole court system. I mean, and one thing people in New York City know about Donald Trump is that he hires people and breaks the contract, gets out of it, and he's really known for that. But for the rest of us poor schlubs, we have to, there's laws and the system is in place. That's part of the infrastructure. I mean, the courthouses.
Yeah, another example from the book. There's a couple others. Glenn Lloyd, who started City Fresh Foods here in Boston, and he and his brother, talk about if it weren't for government regulation, knowing that the food that's supplied to him has to be kept below 40 degrees or above, things have to be heated enough or cooled enough, and knowing that his operation is inspected so people can rely on the food that he's providing. All of that, food inspection, think of the number of businesses, restaurants, food companies all around the country that can all just rely because of the USDA and regulations like that. They can rely on the food that they're buying being safe. You can walk into any store. You go to other countries, think about it. When you go to another country, do you trust the lettuce? Are you going to drink the water? Are you going to eat at this restaurant? You really have to stop and think and do it on your own. In this country, because of our government's role, all these businesses can do business with one another, and we can do business with those businesses, and that's worth a lot. When you die, we talk about the estate tax. You built a business in this country. Bill Gates Sr. will say, if you put my son down in a developing country, there is no Microsoft. There's none of this. There's no research. There's no internet. There's no publicly educated employees. There's no opportunity. So what do we owe back? What do you owe back when it comes time to die in this country? Currently with $11 million, you have to have $11 million before you even pay a penny in the estate tax. And they're talking about either repealing that or doubling that exemption. Makes no sense.
It makes no sense. And, Barack Obama, no raging liberal, got in, some hot water for saying that, well, wealthy people don't do it all by themselves. And he was right. And what you just pointed out is exactly right. So again, we've come yet again to the end of the show. What website can you point people to go to?
For yours. And read this letter at responsiblewealth.org. And our parent organization is faireconomy.org, United for a Fair Economy.
And it makes so much sense. Maybe. Well, we'll see. Call your member of Congress, 202-224-3121. Okay. Thank you again, Mike Lapham. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bert. Anytime.
Thank you.
Stealing from a boy like me. I've been out working day and night since I was small. I know you gotta take your share, but do you have to take it all? Nickel and diamond me to death, squeezing from me my last breath. Leave me and my friends alone. You're busting up our happy home. Tax collector, there's a change in the weather. You telling me if I give you everything, well, can I keep the rest for me? Well, I've got news for you. No, no, that'll never do. I'm tired of paying the bills on some of the things you do. Nickel and diamond me to death, squeezing from me all of my breath. Leave me and my friends alone. You're busting up our happy home. A tax collector, there's a change in the weather.